Sunset Lake CBD is a majority employee-owned hemp farm located right outside of Burlington, Vermont. Before they started growing hemp, Sunset Lake Farms produced cream for Ben & Jerry's. Sunset Lake CBD doesn't use any pesticides or herbicides to grow any of its hemp plants, and they use organic fertilizer and other sustainable farming techniques to ensure the long-term health of the soil and to minimize their carbon footprint. So like all of us, my days are really stressful. By the end of the night, my kids are in bed, I'm taking a minute to chill, but I'm still unwinding. I recently started using the Relax Gummies infused with CBD isolate, reishi mushroom extract, and ashwagandha root extract. I'm really glad I tried these because they really helped me get ready for a good night of sleep, and I really think I sleep better, so I'd highly recommend it. Check out Sunset Lake CBD today at sunsetlakecbd.com and use the code UNDERMINE for 20% off your order. That's sunsetlakecbd.com and use the code UNDERMINE for 20% off your order. Farmer-owned, Vermont-grown, Sunset Lake CBD. Hey listeners, I want to tell you about Music Masters Collective, a nonprofit organization that produces unique music events, providing opportunities for fans and artists to meet and collaborate in an inspired and creative atmosphere. These events give you the opportunity to learn from world-class musicians like the Fab Four, Steve Earle, Richard Thompson, John Scofield, Nels Klein, the Milk Carton Kids, and many more. This June, join the Wait Band, featuring members of the band and the Levon Helm Band with special guests, including Jimmy Vivino, Bob Margolin, Lost Leaders, Chris O'Leary, Cindy Cashdollar, Stony Creek Band, Rob Fraboni, Larry Packer, and so many more at Camp Cripple Creek. This all-inclusive music vacation in the Catskill Mountains of upstate New York promises to be a once-in-a-lifetime experience featuring performances, workshops, jams, comfortable lodging, and superb dining. Visit campcripplecreek.com/undermine to register today. That's campcripplecreek.com/undermine.
Osiris.
We are on the back of the worm. Hopefully, we'll find out what that means in this episode. I think we've said it a few times. Hello, and welcome to season four of the Undermine podcast by Osiris Media. I'm Tom Marshall, your host of these proceedings. We're near the middle of our season at episode 23, a season where we're exploring fish in the 90s. We're visiting some epic shows of the early 90s and then drawing ever closer to our goal, the famous Fall 97 tour. And we're kind of at the edge of that right now. Today, our shows are the 1st and 2nd of July 97 in Amsterdam, of all places, at the famous Paradiso. And to help me explore this European detour right before the fall of 97, I'm here with the gruff but lovable CEO of Osiris, my co-host, RJB.
Hey, Tom. This is the actual, real, genuine halfway point of the season. We have 46 episodes, and this is number 23. So based on my math, we're right in the middle. We made it.
46 episodes till the coal runs out or something like that, they said.
Yeah, something like that. Today, we're diving into our second Amsterdam visit of the series, both from 97. Of course, you heard 217. Now we're at July 1st and July 2nd. Wild, wacky shows that sometimes make me feel like I'm watching or listening to band practice. I'm looking forward to getting into these shows. We have a great guest, someone who everyone's familiar with, and I think we'll shed some light on a lot of this stuff. So before we get into it, if you enjoy what we're doing, please consider supporting our new Osiris Premium offering. You can join for a few bucks a month. You'll get bonus episodes, ad-free episodes. You can access the full Under the Scales catalog, discounts on stuff, meet and greets, and more. OsirisPod.com/premium or click on the link in the show notes. And thanks for your support. Thomas, who do we have today?
Today, our guest on Undermine, I'm pleased to announce, is the infamous Scott Marks. Scott Marks is my bro. He is everybody's bro. He's BizArchive on Twitter, always tweeting a ton of relevant fish facts. And he also often live tweets the set list during shows. He's a board member of the fan-run volunteer organization Mockingbird, which has done so much for us fans, but also for music education, having recently surpassed $2 million in gifts to schools and students. And Scott seems to tour endlessly, and he's never shy about the love he has for his favorite band. Let's bring him in from the waiting chamber where he's been holding his breath. I hope he's okay. Scott, did you survive your time in the waiting room? There he is.
Barely
here.
You look safe. You made it.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to talk about these shows.
You are more than welcome. Thank you for coming. And RJ, would you agree that our guest today is Scott Marks?
I don't know. That's what I've heard a bunch of times. I'm not sure, but I think so.
Okay, that's not up for debate then. Okay, there's lots of debates with Phish and set lists and stuff, and Scott is often right at the root of it. But hello and welcome, sir, Scott. For our listeners, when did you start going to Phish shows?
Fall 1997, so a couple of months after the Paradiso, and I got the bug immediately and have been going ever since.
So for the record, you were not at these shows that we're talking about tonight.
I was not.
But you are a student of them.
Yeah, the second night of this run is one of my favorite shows of any era of Phish. So I'm very excited to take a dive into this.
Let's do it.
It's going to be wild. I guess, first of all, Scott, we talked about some of the themes. We're going to talk about the music, obviously, in depth. But the sound of these soundboards, particularly, on the live official releases, it's so intimate and so powerful. It feels like you're there. And Scott, I know you were talking about, you're thinking about sort of like the size of the venues. And this feels like after the hugeness of 95, 96, they're kind of getting back into these smaller venues. And I think that's reflected in the playing, but I feel like the sound itself is just, it feels so intimate.
The shows that came out of the Amsterdam 97 box set at the Paradiso, the sound is pristine. And really at any of these venues you're looking at during the winter, spring, and the summer tours, the Paradiso is what, 1500 capacity, and you're looking at other venues that were between 1000 and 2000. And even something like the Royal Albert Hall, which is over 5,000, you go listen to the Dylan show from 66, the quality of that's fantastic as well. So I think with technology being what it is and with remastering recordings, and these are just like, you wouldn't even know you were listening to like a live show until you actually hear the audience. There's no crowd at all. Like when the show is going on, it's really special. And I think they did a fantastic job putting this together.
What do you think it was like for fans to be there? I actually don't know anyone who was at these shows personally, I don't think. Have you talked to people who were at these shows, Scott or Tom?
Just Brad Sands, really. I showed up later. I wasn't here in the winter.
So I don't know anyone who was here for 97. Adam Scheinberg, president of the Mockingbird Foundation, was there for a bunch of the 98 summer shows before they went back to the States. And again, those were similar sized venues. So for me, I wasn't there, but it would be a dream experience to see Phish in intimate venues like that. Like the closest I got was at the Met a couple of years ago, which was what, 3,500. So not,
yeah,
super intimate, but compared to seeing shows at MSG or the Gorge or Alpine, it was something that, I really rarely got a chance to see the band in venues of that size. I did the Fox Theater in 2009 and in Radio City in 2000. But again, these are still 2-3 times the size of something like the Paradiso.
Yeah. So crazy. And Tom, I think we're going to get into some of your Europe adventures a little bit later, because I know you weren't at these shows. But I want to ask you, Tom, before we get into the music, there were some songs that were being debuted on this tour that had, you know, lasting power and also like bring this kind of darkness to the music. Saw It Again, Ghost are the ones that come to mind, but we got to talk to Trey about the story of the Ghost several years ago, but what was going on with you when you were writing these songs, Saw It Again, Ghost, were you, cause Fish took it to a dark place musically in a good way, but where was your head at?
I kind of see what you're saying about, like, you know, Saw It Again and Ghost, like, you know, a horrible beast outside the window that wants to come in, and then a ghost, you know, waiting in the wind and rain on the doorstep. It sounds similar, but in fact, it's kind of light years apart. Saw It Again was simply like a nightmare, a horrifying apparition at the window, like in a horror movie where finally the lightning flash shows that you aren't imagining it, but there actually is something fixated upon you outside that wants to come in and harm you. Whereas Ghost is actually about a friendly spirit who is helping me navigate adolescence, whom I was certain had taken up residence in my friend Phil Duminadier in eighth grade. And of course, Phil is horrified about that now. But he denied it, but also he didn't. He would say things that only the spirit would know. And I convinced myself that he was kind of hiding it from me. But anyway, as a result, it made a huge impression on me that I decided to describe to my best friend Trey the way he likes best in a song. And that's, I feel I've never told you the story of the ghost. And anyway, I think we do a deep dive into Ghost on one of the older Under the Scale. So we don't have to go too deep into that, but that's kind of, those two songs are definitely same era, but different sides of the coin. It might be time to, RJ, it might be a little early in the show, but if we dive into the music after this, it might be a good time to have a break and talk to our sponsors. What do you think?
That'd be good. And then we have plenty of time to talk about the music. All right, let's do it.
Okay, it's time to take a break. When we return, we will dive deep into this show.
Hey, listeners, I want to tell you about one of our great partners, DistroKid. DistroKid makes music distribution fun and easy with unlimited uploads and artists keeping 100% of their royalties and earnings. If you're a musician and looking to get your music out there, DistroKid is the way to go. DistroKid is available for iOS and Android and is now available in Apple's App Store and the Google Play Store. More than a million artists rely on DistroKid to get their music onto Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram, and all other major streaming services. And with DistroKid, you can upload new releases, see your financial progress, get notified when you've earned royalties, withdraw money from the app, view and share links, check your streaming stats, and a whole lot more. DistroKid has more features than any other music distributor. Check them out today. Go to distrokid.com, that's distrokid with a capital K, .com/VIP/undermine for a special offer only for our listeners. That's distrokid, capital K, .com/VIP/undermine. Thanks, DistroKid. Hi, listeners. I want to tell you about a cause that I'm involved with at Heritage Radio Network. HRN is celebrating its 15th year. And to celebrate, we're deepening our commitment to giving voice to the next generation of food system storytellers, and we need your help. Our internship and fellowship programs help activate new possibilities for underrepresented and underestimated young people through experiential journalism, audio engineering, and production training. Through these unique programs, HRN helps food equity stewards build essential workforce readiness skills that expand their potential and foster economic mobility. Please consider supporting these critical programs. And with a minimum donation, you can be entered to win a dinner for two at an amazing restaurant in one of eight cities and tickets to a concert at a great venue in one of those cities. We have incredible partners across the country who have donated, as they also share our passion for helping to educate the next generation of food system storytellers. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. And make sure you donate before March 31st. Thank you.
All right. We are back with Scott Marks.
Scott, I don't know how we should get into these two days of music, because there's a lot to talk about. But I guess one of the things is that we immediately get on the back of the worm at the very outset here with the ghost opener in the first night. I know this is another example of kind of taking fans on a journey, but what do you feel about that ghost and how it kind of set the stage for those 2 days?
So Ghost had been around for just over 2 weeks at this point. And each time it was being played, it was getting longer and longer. And you hit over 20 minutes to open the show. And so already it was becoming a jam vehicle, if you will. There was funky grooves that were all over the improvisation. It was just kind of the style that Fish had gotten into at that point, which began, I think, in those June shows on Europe. And you can hear it on 4598, where Trey's talking about this funk groove they've gotten into and they can't get out of it. So the band acknowledged it, and it's easy to hear. And you had the Back of the Worm banter going on with Trey and Fish, which showed up for Ghost and for a bunch of songs that night, and the Wormtown jam the next night, and then even a couple of nights later out in Italy for a couple of songs showed up. So it definitely, the band played around with the idea for a bit and just kept popping songs, popping the Back of the Worm stuff into various things.
I feel like that set is really, I mean, that Ghost is really kind of, it's definitely an interesting, like you said, 20 minute adventure. And then there's a really cool Yamar. I mean, everything is so loose, you know, it just feels like a very loose show. The Limb by Limb, and then into like the Ain't Love Funny, Saw It Again, sort of like gets a little dark, but like, again, not in a horrible, not in a like scary way. It's just sort of like, I don't even know how I would describe the sound. Do you have a description for it?
It's out there. I wouldn't call it dark. Maybe a little bit of ambience and just space. And they had a chance to play around with things. There, you can definitely hear in these two shows them going off. You know, it's type two, if you will, where it's out of the song structure, but it's not necessarily a raging jam, but it's out there and they're kind of exploring, and then they eventually find where they want to go. You have the cities that goes out there, and even a little bit after the Limb by Limb in the first set, it doesn't end properly, and so they definitely were exploring in a lot of different areas for these shows.
I mean, that set two opens with the, you know, Fishman on the playing the piano, and then like, and then the timber, which is a very good version. And like you said, the gin into huge cities. There, these 2 days, there's a lot of just jam labels, you know, which is fun. I remember getting these tapes and just being like, what the hell happened? Tom, can I ask you, you've done some Europe just to like get the context. What was it like seeing Fish in Europe in the, you know, 96, 97, 98? And why do you think these shows sound so different to us? I mean, were they different to you being a fan kind of with them on the road?
Oh, definitely. I mean, Fish already here in the US had already kind of grown to a certain size. And you guys have both touched on it. Like, you're getting a chance to see Fish again in these small venues. And it was outrageous. And the, you know, people, I missed this part of the summer, this part of the tour, but I showed up for the kickoff in Dublin. I was there, Dublin, London, Austria, and Prague. And I'd been to Europe a bit with Fish before and some other travel, but this time was like outrageous. The band was so good, and those small theaters and all the Americans who went from show to show all became pals, and we would party late into the night after the shows. We never left the USA time zone. I never acclimated to European time because we just stayed up all night. And if I'm not mistaken, the night in Vienna, June 19th, 97, was the famous meat stick night, where Trey uttered those words about the last sad looking piece of sausage in the hotel mini fridge. He said, "It's time for the meat stick." and then Sophie and Trey, of course, turned it into a dance like the Macarena. And oh man, it was a hilarious, wonderful time traveling around with European fish. It was like unsupervised, not under the spotlight, like the parents weren't watching, you know? We were on our own thrashing around the continent from show to show, and I'll never forget it.
Scott, what's your recommendation for this first show? Like, if you were going to go to one thing, because there's so much going on and there's so many great pieces of improv, is there a segment or a particular song that you would point people to?
I'm a little biased on this, but I'd go right to The Ghost. Just the raging opener to the show, and the banter. It's near and dear to my heart, and I just am really tied to that.
It's so ridiculous. I mean, the gin is great, but The Ghost, I mean, what a way to kick off these shows. And I think, you know, we can talk more about this as we talk about July 2nd, but this is kind of the peak of the year up to this point, right? These 2 days. And I mean, I think it's hard to choose between the two, but there's a lot going on here. I listened to both these shows twice because I was like, I still couldn't really absorb all of the different, well, shenanigans, but jams also. There's so much happening. I will say, I think, you know, you can search for this on the internet, but the Back of the Worm story, according to the internet, I think that Trey did an interview at some point and said there was a wild night in Amsterdam that sort of spurred that Back of the Worm phrase, and then it just, you know, kind of made its way into the music. And one thing he said in this interview, and I don't know where the interview is from, so it might not be real, but I think it is, he said, like, when they're playing in Amsterdam in the middle of a jam, one of the jams that get out of control and you feel like you're not really playing, it's playing for you, that's when like the Back of the Worm thing came out, which is just, I don't know, it's just wild that this was memorialized and then, like, we have such good sound quality and such a memorable show. It's amazing.
Oh, and you have Trey giving the story the second night about how, you know, you had a wild night in the canals and ended up riding on the Back of the Worm all night. And so, you know, I'd love to go check it out and hear, like, if there's an actual real story behind it. But it just, it's entertaining and it's creative and just fun.
Yeah, it really is. So the second night, Scott, I think you had said in your notes or in our back and forth that you feel like the second night is like the pinnacle of this year to up to this point.
So again, this is where someone's bias can kick in, but for possibly my favorite fish jam of all time, it's that stash in the second set. The beautiful melodic portion that goes on for several minutes just hits in all the right spots. I guess it depends on mood. Sometimes I'll go for a Tweezer or Mike song, but just that improvisation that they came up with was perfect. And song selection for that night, you got a lot of great shows that open with a Mike song. And so again, right off the bat, you're plunging right into an amazing set to open up the night.
And it's so good. That stash is just so good. I mean, they do come out of the gate with the, as you said, the Mike song and the first set opener into Simple, into Maze. One of the things I like about these shows, I was talking about like the intimacy of the sound, but on the official releases, you can hear Trey, like before Vultures, he's like, you know, let's do Vultures, you know, and like the night before, you can just hear him kind of calling the songs, and it's really fun to hear. That first set it's pretty well balanced, you know, like Water in the Sky into Weekapog to close it was like a pretty, I mean, you know, totally different songs, but it really works. And then the second set, I mean, I guess if you count the Wormtown thing as a song, it's four songs, but it's really like just three songs, which is pretty outrageous. I mean, that set, Scott, is, I mean, you can't really complain about it at all.
You know, you'll have people that will sometimes complain about the placement of Awaiting in a Velvet Sea.
Right at the end. And, yeah.
And it was perfect placement in this, out of the jam. And it's delicate going into it, and just it felt like it was stripped down, and perhaps it's just with the venue, but it worked. And so the song placement, the song selection was just, you know, right up my alley for this show.
I'll never complain about placement of Velvet Sea. I mean, the ultimate version of this, which maybe they practiced here, was I would say Big Cypress, where, you know, the sun was coming up and they played Velvet Sea. That was a whole different thing. But to me, this, when I heard it, because I just listened in the car. I wasn't looking at a set list, and I was like, what is this? Like, that stash is outrageous. And then the llama, and then whatever the Wormtown craziness, Velvet Sea, it was like a breath of needed fresh air for me. I loved it.
I mean, you gotta do that. You gotta take a breather every once in a while, right? Even if you're jamming in Amsterdam for 2 days. Scott, that stash, you mentioned the melodic kind of beautiful space. It's really pretty amazing. And I guess was stash, do you feel like this was the beginning of some of these more classic songs that started to take on different forms or not adhering to typical forms? Like, you know, 96, 95, you didn't really see stash or Bowie. I guess like a couple of versions of Bowie, but this is when like these songs kind of just become, any song can become a jam vehicle, it feels like.
Yeah, I think I'd have to sit down and pinpoint where it all began, but you know, it was definitely going on at this point, and you would see it in the fall with other songs popping out. I think like there's a Timber that got released as like a From the Archives, which also kind of got out there, I think similar into like the melodic type 2 or type 10 or whatever you want to call it, jam at that point. So you're so off the reservation, you've gone off of whatever jam you're going into. I think it's much more common now where you're going to have songs that are completely leaving their structure. And the Axla part 2 in Vegas last year, where they just like, we're going to jam this out and we're going to do it. But you go back to really August 93, I think was when songs started to really explore themselves. And you have 94 with the Bowies that were going 25, 30 minutes. And so this is just another chapter of the improvisation at this point.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I guess that had been slowly happening. These shows are great. I mean, Tom, given that you're less of a jam centric person than probably Scott or I are, what was your impression going back to these, or what did anything sound wise that jumped out to you, like as we start to move toward the fall?
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, I was going to say waiting was sort of a welcome thing. In the first set, the Strange Design to me was sort of a welcome little breather. And I like Strange Design. I always liked it. And this was just, you know, a nice version. It's nothing that the Jam crazy people are going to write home about. But to me, it was a welcome break.
It's all right, this happened once before.
Definitely a song guy, and it was kind of nice also to see Vultures begin to really take off. For that's not a pun or anything. And then Water in the Sky is really a song that I can't tell if they've kind of left behind a little bit, but it was a fixture, and I always loved it. So this show, I agree, of the two nights, this is my favorite of the two. And yeah, that second set is outrageous, but I really love the first set and the song choice.
What? Yeah, I think the Strange Design definitely works in that first set. And, you know, part of it's definitely songs that you prefer to hear at a show, but I think just, again, the placement was perfect.
Yep. And he was just calling it. You could tell, like RJ said, there was no structure. They were just, like I said, spotlight off, camera off. They're in front of a small group of people, and they're just kind of like, it's band practice for the United States, right? They're going to go back and do a tour. Let's get the craziness out here and try anything and everything.
And you had 13 songs that debuted in those first two nights of the tour, and so you have other shows that had a lot of debuts, but these just stuck. And then you had three things like The Ghost, The Twist, and The Piper all made their debuts, and they've been monsters ever since.
Scott, what do you think about Ain't Love Funny? I think is a really good cover, and maybe it's venue size. I saw it, I guess, a month after this at Alpine, the last time they played it in the summer of 97. But I think it's a pretty cool song, but maybe it's a song that just doesn't translate to a big amphitheater. Do you think that, or maybe they were just playing with it that summer and then, you know, decided to kind of drop it like a lot of songs. I don't know. Any thoughts on that?
I don't know. Mike played it in his own band years later. So perhaps it was something that he wanted to play, and then the band collectively decided to can it after a couple shows. But, you know, it's nice hearing that in this show and again a couple of times during the tour.
Yeah, it's cool. It's like it's a very nice, quiet cover. So, Scott, as we go forward, we have one more stop after this before we get to Fall 97, which is what we've been kind of, you know, working our way up to. What do you see as the kind of legacy of these shows, or where do you see Phish, as, you know, at this point, as they're kind of heading into the, you know, summer in US and then Fall 97.
I think the legacy of these shows was the introduction of the funk. That style definitely shifted the band forever. So I feel that's, and again, the amount of songs that debuted, and I think Trey had written like a couple of dozen songs in the weeks before these shows, and then you just had them all showing up. It's something that you don't necessarily see anymore, where, you know, the last couple of tours, they haven't had an opening show or they've debuted several songs like this. So it almost seems like it's been a thing in the past where you'll have songs that'll debut, but it'll be like a song or two here or a song or two there, as opposed to nights where you'd have 5, 6, 7, 8 songs debuting all at once and then seeing which songs work. Like you had a couple of things like Waking Up, which didn't really do anything, and Bye Bye Foot vanished until it reappeared in Providence, and then other songs that were there for good. And so it's interesting to see how it all shakes out. But those songs and the funk style definitely are legacies from this tour.
Yeah, that's a great perspective. I think, I guess one thing I want to just, we didn't really talk about this, but Sky, you mentioned in our back and forth before this, just the Wormtown, Back of the Worm sort of thing. I mean, it's really just a kind of continuation of Phish taking fans with them on these, you know, inside jokes. Where does this fit for you in like the pantheon of absurd, ridiculous inside jokes?
I don't think it was really too much of an inside joke as opposed to like the secret language, where in 1990 it took months for people to catch on to it. But it's something where they've had a tradition of doing things like this, where you'd have a joke or a gag one night and show up the next night. Like in 1991 at the Trax, they said their name was Mrs. Piece of Shit. So they completely, you know, changed the name of the band and then insert it a couple of times. And then the next night up at the Bayou in DC, they did it again. And so, you know, you didn't have tapes showing up immediately, and maybe not everyone was at the second show that was at the first show. And then if you wanted to go real inside baseball, and they did the Ninth Cube this past year, they're talking about someone who's having a kid and pineapple on pizza, and all of a sudden Mrs. Pizza Shit shows up. And so I think Fishman mentions it, and then Trey's like, oh, I totally forgot about that. And so they're all joking, and then they have to try and get back on track. So definitely inside baseball at that point. But like even more recently in 2012, they had the tucking thing that showed up a couple of times in that summer 2012 tour. And while it wasn't a gag, the fall 2019 tour, they had the plasma riff that kept showing up constantly throughout that tour in Providence and then certainly in South Carolina. So it's like if you go to all the shows, you'll catch the connection, but otherwise if you only go to one show, you might not realize that something else had happened beforehand. And especially in the 90s, where you didn't have stuff at your fingertips, you'd have to find out later on, and then you're like, oh, all right, Back of the Worm was done both nights in Amsterdam, and then they did it again a couple of nights later in Italy. So I think for that, you had a lot of people that were from America doing multiple shows, but if someone randomly showed up at the show in Italy and they're like, what's going on here? with Back of the Worm showing up in a Harry Hood or Sample in a Jar, and there it is. And they'd have no idea what was going on, but people that were at the other shows would be in on it. So it's definitely something that has been going on through much of the band's career.
Totally. It's like, if you were there for the origin of it, then it's not an inside, then you're part of the inside joke. But if they just all of a sudden drop a worm on you, you have no idea what's going on. And yet, that's what we all love about the band, is that, you know, they can all of a sudden take a left turn, and some people know what's going on, some people don't. Everyone eventually figures it out.
I mean, you know, all Phish fans kind of know this, but, you know, in our conversation with John Peluska, I asked him if he ever considered, you know, whether he should ask, you know, persuade the band to be less goofy on stage, especially in these big moments, you know, playing MSG or play whatever. And it's like, you know, what he said, which is of course what we all know, is like, that's what you get. And that's part of what makes them special. And I just think it's cool that they've consistently kind of like bucked the, you know, taking themselves too seriously. And I think that it has done well for them.
Well, even with these 97 shows, they were already playing in arenas in 95 and 96. And then they've dialed back the intimacy and the joke and the theme. You don't really see that too much these days, but I feel like it was done a lot more when they were playing the smaller venues.
Man, this was fun. I hope that everyone listening and watching feels like we did this justice, because there's a lot of music here, and I think we all collectively probably spent, you know, 15 hours listening to these shows to deliver this to our friends.
No question. I would say listen to The Stash, July 2nd, 97. It really is outrageous. And then if you want to know about The Worm, listen a little bit later in that set. I think in that set Yes. Wormtown. It's sort of like Steve Miller, right? It's got to get down to
Swingtown.
Yeah. It's a Steve Miller song that they say Wormtown. And of course, you know, the funny thing about that is the beat, it's the drum beat. Ding, 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 ding. That's something that like drummers learn. It's like a famous drum beat. And so Fishman and Trey, of course, as drummers knew that beat. Anyway.
It's twisted, so but it's good.
It's twisted and it's good. Yep, for sure. I think that's it for us today. And we want to say thank you to the famous Scott Marks, and thanks to all you listeners and the Osiris team. We have to mention our really good friends at Cash or Trade, the world's only social network where fans buy, sell, and trade tickets at face value. They're really good friends of Osiris. Check them out at cashortrade.org. Remember to review and subscribe wherever you listen or watch. And goodbye. And please remember to bring a few companions on the ride with you. Thanks again, Scott. And thank you, RJ.
Yeah, Scott, we'll see you again this season. You're going to be back.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Osiris.
Hey, this is Steve Choi, host of the Musicians Guild podcast, part of the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. Within the four walls of the Musicians Guild, we'll be discussing the habits, idiosyncrasies, experiences, and general psychology of my friends and peers all involved with music in various capacities. Listen and subscribe at soundtalentmedia.com.
Hi, I'm Daniela Clark.
I'm Barbara Ann Wild.
And we are the Honest AF Show.
Our podcast is real, honest conversation with our celebrity friends and pros.
Covering our anything but average rock and roll lifestyles.
All while tackling the hell that is aging and the battle of beauty.
Oh yeah, nothing is off the table.
The Honest AF Show is available wherever you get your podcasts.